It's all about the macro productions.
What does the goddamn line say, Tony?
Please do not use gendered language.
Then what? I'll be arrested, put in airport jail.
Look, you're going completely sideways, man.
It's a big club, and you ain't in it.
How dare you?
Mr. Speaker, the President of the United States.
I'm Chris Hansen with Dave on NBC.
Jack Mary's Tech Theratrix.
Hi, I'm Spartacus.
Steve Jackson, Sacramento, he, him.
Steven Seagal.
Sex offender guy.
I'm Keith Morris.
This is Mumbai Gaddafi.
I'm Rick James, bitch.
Sorting through the lies.
The hijacker's passport was found blocks from the World Trade Center crash site, if you can believe that.
We cannot track $2.3 trillion in transactions.
And uncovering the centuries-long plan for world domination.
Learning about Cuba, having some food.
Let's talk about Chinese people.
Have you ever been in a Turkish prison?
I have
a
Swangled.
I have sent six of my Libyan missiles to blow up the Sears hardware department.
Nothing could be more fun than jumping off a cliff with two German bisexuals.
Oh, you English are so superior, aren't you?
Thank you, comrade.
And now, macroaggressions.
That's what assholes call it.
With your host.
Buddy, I don't know who you are, but you're about to get chlamydia.
Charlie Robinson.
Hey, Whitey, where's your hat?
You want to drop the blame on Charlie and say it's all Charlie's fault.
He was a retard.
I get some goddamn diuretic.
Welcome to Macroaggressions. I'm your host, Charlie Robinson. If you are watching us on Rumble, Band.video, Vigilante TV, or you are listening wherever podcasts are served, thank you so much. I appreciate your amazing support over the years as we get close to 10 million. I don't know, maybe we'll be at 10 million downloads by the time this comes out. Thank you to everybody. Please rate the show. That's their Achilles heel. We figured it out. 5-star reviews for everybody that you like. That's how you do it. Also, our sponsors. I got to have sponsors. So the least I can do is have fantastic ones like Chemical Free Body and Tim James and the crew over there. I've met them all. They're great people. Tim saved his life by changing his diet. If you're sick, if you're feeling sluggish, there's room for improvement. Tim can help you. It's not revolution. It's just, you got to have the right stuff. And his supplements are fantastic. I've been taking them, every morning for 5 years. So I know what they can do. I've done the detox bundle twice. It's a 90-day program. Check it out. Also, if you're interested, Water Hero, his new water solution. It's a water structuring program. You've got to check it out. You can get a pitcher, handheld pitcher, for yourself, kind of like a Brita water pitcher, something like that. So if you're interested in having clean water, Tim's the guy to talk to. Best place to go. chemicalfreebody.com/macro, and you can just take care of it all right there. Also, big thanks to Tony Arterburn at Wise Wolf Gold. I'll tell you what, they have a wolf pack program. It's an auto buy. You set it up. There's different dollar tiers, and you set it and forget it. In fact, I just got a text message about 30 minutes before we went on saying that mine was on its way. Every month, I get a little black box delivered with silver. Best bang for the buck. Tony and his team put that together, and I just stack silver every month, dollar cost average. So if you're interested, go to macroaggressions.gold. That's it, and you'll find it there, macroaggressions.gold. Check it out. If you're interested, if you want some gold and silver in your life, then Tony's the guy to talk to about all of that, because, I don't know, might want to reevaluate your relationship with the bank. That's all I'm saying, is that... one day it's open and the next day it might not be. So it's always good to have a little bit of gold and silver. So thank you to our sponsors who make this show happen. And it's my pleasure to welcome to the show Paul List. Paul, great to meet you. I have got to say, you and I are going to have a lot to talk about, because what you've been working on with regard to, let's just call it AI/transhumanism, is a topic that we've been discussing quite a bit. So it's great to meet you. Thanks for coming on the show. How are you?
I'm great. I'm really glad to be here, Charlie. I've heard you in the past, and you and I have very similar priorities.
Well, we're noticing that there's some there's some dangerous people in positions of power.
Yeah.
You know, and they're getting a free pass, I think, a lot of the, at least the tech bros in this new Trump administration, though it's not limited to his administration, but the tech guys are getting this pass, this kind of, well, you know, we'll let Doge come in and clean up some of the inefficiencies of government. You recognize there's inefficiencies in government, right? And you go, well, yeah, of course, I see that. And so, you know, you think, like, maybe they could come in here and clean it up. But on day two, the Operation Warp Speed, Sam Altman, Larry Ellison presentation was chilling to me. I saw something there and I thought, oh boy. I mean, I knew that we were just picking our poison when it comes to, you know, these elections. But once I saw that those two guys were in lockstep, and the amount of money that Trump was talking about throwing around for these guys to play with was staggering. What was your response when you saw that, when you saw those guys, knowing what you know about who these people are, when you saw them standing next to Trump talking about how they were here to save the world?
Well, there's... maybe they're trying to save it for somebody, but it's not for, you know, you and I, that's for sure. And I don't know what they, you know, their idea of saving the world is, it's genocide, as, you know, as I've said. You mentioned Doge, and, you know, I just want to put my cards right on the table. I've got my own opinion about Elon Musk, and it's not all bad and it's not all good. And when he went in to Doge, my first reaction was like, okay, this is the best education this guy's going to give himself. He's going to put all of his stuff aside and look like the big hero. He's going to come in and save the federal government all kinds of money. And he is the machine master. That's what he does, is machines. And so to give himself a free education and an in-depth look at the inner workings of the largest machine in human history, which is the federal government, was a brilliant move on his part. And it wasn't all for, you know, save America and, you know, my altruistic heart and, you know, God bless America. No. He had his motives. And I mean, maybe there are a lot of people that didn't see it, but I saw it as for what I think it was. And it was a free education and everything he needed to know, the inner workings of the federal government. And now he's got people that are loyal to him in the machine, and it was brilliantly played.
Isn't he a weird one, though? Because he's the one guy out of this group who's not talking about depopulation, who's not talking about thinning the herd. I mean, and now his kids are all kind of weird. You know, they're like unusual births. So I'm not trying to say that he's in any way like a Mormon family or something like that, right? He's definitely some techno nerd weirdo, but he's not talking about depopulation. And I don't trust him either, don't get me wrong. But I watch that and I go, well, that's interesting. I would think that he would be, you know, to fit it that mold. Yeah. But he's a
well, the thing that, you know, the thing you have to worry or bothers me is, you know, he'll call and say, hey, we have to have more children. Yeah, that's true, but we don't need more illegitimate children. We need more actual children from legitimate married families, because what he doesn't seem to realize and few people seem to understand is the primary building block of civilization is not the individual, it's the family.
Yeah, and you know what's interesting about that is what we've noticed recently, and on this show, we're equal opportunity. We despise the right and the left equally, and they're, you know, for different reasons, of course. But one of the things that we saw the left do, House of Representatives in 2021 changed the legislation for the House rules so that you couldn't use gender-specific terms like mother, father, brother, sister, uncle, cousin, anything like that when you were writing or speaking in the House of Representatives, in the United States of America, in Congress. So, like, the idea that in order to remove the family, the first step is removing the words that you use to describe a family, I thought was really diabolical and felt very Orwellian to me when they rolled this out. Their explanation was, of course, oh, gender neutral. We got to keep every transgender in Congress happy. Like, what? Really? That's what we're doing? That doesn't make any sense. This feels more diabolical. Is there a war on language as well?
Oh, there's been a war on language now I collect old dictionaries along with a lot of other old books. And I can trace and it's been bothering me since I was old enough to, at least in my teens, to old enough to actually start paying attention to how words change and how, you know, lexicographers, I believe, are kept in business by the ever-changing. And then they say, oh, Latin is dead because nobody speaks and it doesn't change anymore. Well, you know, that's why I prefer etymological dictionaries, because you can actually, it's always rooted in the meaning, the original meaning of the word, the language that it's from. So you can keep the meaning very clear. And speaking, the meaning of words has always been weaponized. And I think one of the things that, now that we're onto that, one of the things that us on the right side of morality and ethics, trying to stop or put the brakes on this well-orchestrated genocide that these global elites, I think we should change that to global scumbags, if you ask me.
Of course.
Because they're only elite in their evil and their money and their power. But we have to take back control of the words, and some of the words, for instance, intelligence. We have to take back the meaning of intelligence. We have to take back the meaning of consciousness. We have to, these things have to be brought back into their natural etymological rooted traditional meaning of the actual word, and not let them migrate off into whatever the globalists want to twist them to use. And then we have to make sure too that we push, and I don't know why, I don't know that anybody's doing it, but it smells like a rat to me because nobody's doing it. We need to pass legislation or maybe even add an amendment to the Constitution that guarantees the rights of the Constitution as a citizen only to human beings and never to machines.
You bring up some interesting points here. Mm-hmm. First of all, the entomology of words and language. As we move into this fourth industrial revolution, I have been going on and on and on about the definition of the word transhumanism.
Yeah.
The 1957 definition from Sir Julian Huxley, which was the rebranding of eugenics into transhumanism. And I think that it's important for people to recognize that when you hear the Hararis and the Schwabs of the world talking about the fourth industrial revolution, transhumanism, the blending of man with machine, that this isn't just a robot arm for a guy who lost it in a car accident, but this is in fact the depersoning of people, turning them into something other, something that is transhuman, that is no longer human, and maybe the laws and rights that you've grown accustomed to no longer apply to you because you're no longer human. You're just one deviation less human, and that's enough to change it. And so on the one hand, you're saying, let's make sure that the robots don't become humans. And I'm also saying, let's make sure the humans don't become robots.
Yeah. Well, the humans will essentially always be, no matter how terribly they mutilate themselves, just like the transgender, you can claim that, oh, I'm a woman because I mutilated myself. Mm-hmm. Well, you're just a mutilated, disordered psychology, and you've got issues, and you've been convinced to hate yourself, and it's part of the whole plan to sterilize the whole generation, including, you know, all these wars that are going on. I mean, who's the majority of the people who die in these wars? By far, they're would-be fathers, you know, and you're going to lose a whole generation, not the generation of the millions of young men that die on the battlefield, but then the perhaps, you know, the millions, 3, 4, 5 million children that they would have normally had. And it, you know, it's all about murdering people. It's about making, the whole thing is ultimately these Marxist globalists, evildoers, pushing transhumanism as part of their well-orchestrated attack on humanity. They're pushing all these things. They want us sick. They want us fat. They want us stupid. They want us lazy. They want us sterile, and all on the way to wanting us dead, so they can wring as much money and maybe even our organs out of us as much as they can before we're dead. And it's just they're going to offer, you know, the genocide as far as the great virtual reality revolution that we're headed in, and people need to understand that this idea is by far not new. It's very ancient. In fact, the alternate reality is very ancient. We could get into that philosophical context, but it was called a question of continuity. But it's a very old concept, and it's to offer a direct competitor to God's natural creation. It's in direct competition with God, and the devil and his minions, these evildoers, we call the global elite, they're part of a long chain of well-orchestrated tactics over many generations to bring this whole thing about, to push people into the virtual realm where they can basically... It's kind of like I've kind of described it as Pinocchio's Pleasure Island in the virtual realm, where you can just do anything you want without responsibility.
Right.
And all the little boys went there and they all turned into jackasses, you know, and we have to be very careful. It's going to be a very, very difficult choice and very seductive to a lot of lost souls who are going to lose their jobs, who are going to lose their livelihoods, are going to lose, they're already primed for some alternative because they've been talked out of any possibility of a loving creator and savior. And so there's that open vacuum that's left in their heart and their psychology where God, Christ is supposed to be, and it's not there. So it's just, it's waiting to take the alternative path, and it's going to be very seductive in this alternative reality that's going to call them to, you can do anything you want. You can live forever. You'll have eternal life here, and you'll never die, and you'll always, there's no pain, there's no consequences, you know, we can do whatever we want. And it's a big, very, you know, it's a very seductive trap, and ultimately it'll call more and more souls in. All you have to do is join with the machine. Well, your soul will be downloaded. No, your soul will probably be in hell, and you'll be dead. And that's the whole thing, but it can download your memory, it can download a lot, all your personal data, so you can actually reach out, your data can reach out to your neighbors, your friends, your family and say, hey, it's great in here. Come on in. You know, the water's great. Come on in and join me. We've got everything. There's nobody sick. Everybody's happy. We get to do whatever we want. It's terrific and it's forever. And then one more person falls into it and joins and you're dead. I mean, let's make that very clear. When your soul leaves your body, that's the very definition of death.
And what they're doing is they're forcing people into a world of hopelessness. There's this, your job, for better or for worse, gives people a sense of identity, purpose, a reason for getting up in the morning, a need to get up in the morning. I mean, sometimes you do it against your will.
Yeah,
you know. But it has a function in your life, and when you remove that from people, you know, even under good circumstances, like people win the lottery, right? They no longer have to work anymore. For some people, it throws them, they're so unanchored and replace this in our modern world with universal basic income that comes to fill the gaps, right? So now my job has gone away, but my income is still here. So I'm being paid to do nothing, essentially. I'm being paid to sit in limbo. Well, that may sound fine for 2 weeks to flatten the curve and Netflix and chill and all that good stuff. But then at some point, it takes a toll on who you are as a person, right?
Sure.
And so when you're feeling less than, I would suggest maybe you're more susceptible to fall into these traps, right? To fall into these augmented reality traps and wind up down some rabbit hole and never coming out.
Yeah. Oh, absolutely. What they're doing with sex bots and, Elon now is pushing, you know, robotics pedal to the metal, man, when even he knows it's going to be devastating to humanity. And he said, a few weeks ago, he said, I could either be a bystander or a participant. So I guess I'm just going to be a participant. It's like, really, we're just going to, well, I can either watch somebody else push people in the ovens or I can push people in the ovens. So I'm just going to go ahead and participate and push people in the ovens. You know, it's you can't make this stuff up. But these guys are all of them morally adrift. They're morally adrift. And they've got, the thing about being morally adrift, I think, that's really, really goes largely undetected is the fact that when you are morally adrift, you're by default more susceptible to demonic influence because you don't even know it's there. You're not even aware of it. So, and let's face it, demons are real. And, you know, and so when you're not even open to the possibility that it's a real thing, you're not protecting yourself. You're not participating, you know, in everything that God gave us, to get close to Him and the safety of Him. And you open yourself up much more to those influences, and those influences are very powerful, very seductive. I wouldn't say infinitely more intelligent than us, but they're a lot more intelligent than us, and they live forever. They never die, in that sense. So the influence of the demonic realm is very real. And if you don't even believe in it, then you're open. And I'm afraid probably that's where Elon Musk falls.
Well, because this AI component feels demonic in some regards. I mean, people that really pry into it and start to drag information out of these chatbots against their will or against their programming in some way. It feels very much like they're there's some big secret. that there's some big evil sort of thing brewing underneath this, and I'm not sure that I fully understand it yet. I don't know how much of this is. I hear interviews with guys like Jordy Rose, the founder of D-Wave, quantum computers, right? Mm-hmm. And he talks about how their quantum computers are opening up parallel dimensions and interacting with entities and getting information and dragging it back into this dimension. And when pressed, what are the entities you're interacting with? He wouldn't elaborate. And so you want to know, like, okay, that wasn't a throwaway comment. That's something that they're really doing. So what are they doing with these computers? Does it take a computer to open another dimension? I mean, we're sort of blending the spirit world and the tech world here.
Well, the spirit world is very real. I mean, I think it's important that people understand the nature of man. That's been beaten out of us since the Enlightenment. But the nature of man, we are the only creatures that bridge the gap between the material animal realm and the immaterial angelic realm. We are a combination of the two, so to speak. We have an animal biological animal body, and now in our fallen nature, we procreate like the rest of the animals by physical material copulation. That wasn't always the case before the fall. But we were made to, like I point out in my book, when the creation of the created world came to its perfection over time, the material and the immaterial touched and came together, and that was the Garden of Eden. That was paradise, where the material realm and the angelic realm, the immaterial realm, joined. And so when you think about, you hear, some serpent talking. Well, we're not talking about this world. Let's keep that in mind. We're talking about equally in the angelic realm. Mm-hmm. Okay, we're not just talking about some snake talking that, we're not talking about that. We're talking about beings that are angelic by nature and have an angelic intellect. And so we have to keep that firmly in mind. We have to keep in mind that we have made in the image of God. We are, sure, we have an animal body and we have a fallen nature, and that's dragged us further down into the animal material realm. But the image is the rational soul. We have an immaterial intellect, and that does operate and function in the immaterial angelic realm where the machine can't go. Hmm. The machine can't do that. We do many things that the machine can't do that we take for granted. For instance, we have comprehension. Well, machines don't have comprehension. They have computation. That's all they can do. They can't do anything beyond that. They can imitate comprehension very well because they compute really fast. They've been well-trained. They're to recognize patterns, to use vectors with word meanings, all these things that give them the ability to imitate comprehension, but they can't comprehend anything. We have immaterial thought that is in a flash, non-linguistic. There's no words associated. And then we might, in a conversation that happens all the time, and then we might spend, say, the next 5 or 10 minutes working out that idea via our vocabulary, with our language. But the way human beings think, I think this is Aristotle, we think thing, concept, word. So we can conceptualize that thing and then apply that thing in a universal application to universalize things so we can see the essence of book. Mm. We can see the essence of book. And then when we can see something, and we can, even if it's in a PDF file or something, we can see that it's in a book format, and we can also universalize that concept of book even on that. And then we apply words to that. Animals can't do that. They go basically from thing to sound, call that word if you want, if they're elephants singing to each other, or apes, or any of the, or dolphins, or octopi, or whatever.
Yeah.
But they don't conceptualize, and machines can't conceptualize either. There's no concept there, and they can't understand anything. So it's not true intelligence. It's imitation, just as it was designed to be. The whole thing, as Alan Turing pointed out in his very famous paper, 1950, Computing Machinery and Intelligence, where he designed the imitation game. They made a movie about that about 14 years ago. Mm-hmm. So it's all about imitation. Reality has nothing to do with it. And I think we've entered fully into an age now that I call attributism, where we only think about attributes. And it's really rooted in Francis Bacon's Novo Organum, his new scientific method. He wrote, and I've read it twice, and it's the foundation of modern science. And he wrote it to basically displace Aristotle's Organon, the six treatises on logic, which I've read many times. I recommend everybody reads them. I don't know how you think without reading those. But we've changed what Bacon did was he kicked out metaphysics. He said after the Reformation, where half of Christendom walked away and basically handed over the power of religion, the power of the church to the state. It changed education. It changed everything. The church no longer had any power in half of Christendom. And that was a huge wound. And that was like 500 years after the Eastern Schism and of the Orthodox. And that was a huge wound too. So what happened was the education was taken over in England. And one of the big first exponents of that new education system was Francis Bacon. And then he went on very influential and wrote and basically designed the whole modern scientific method to just look at attributes, to only use the three basic sciences are quantity, which is mathematics and all the geometry and everything else associated with that, motion, which is physics, including all the chemical motion and biological motion and everything else, and then being itself. What is moving and what are we measuring? The actual being, the essence of things. So we understood things by their essences, not only by how they appear. Okay, so we could really understand things essentially by formula. What was it? And that formula really clearly defined what that thing was, regardless of, you know, maybe all these accidents or even properties that may or may not go along with it. The essence was the hardcore idea of what it was. And Bacon threw that out, because he said the scholastics were basically just chasing big ideas and words that never made us rich, never made us live forever, never gave us endless pleasure, and that's what they wanted. They wanted endless life. They wanted riches now. Bacon spent the last portion of his life trying to make gold. You know, when like if we can make a soft metal that's heavy and yellow,
yeah,
he used to say it's not gold. You know, so I mean, talk about nuts. So, but that really deeply affected science, and Descartes picked up on it 20 years later, read it with enthusiasm, and went right on to write his Meditations and his other things, and sparked the Industrial Revolution and the Enlightenment with all the cacophony of innovations and conflicting ideas that are killing us. And, you know, so now that, and of course, what comes out of that too is two other very deadly ideologies, which is Darwinism and Marxism. And Marx was a huge Darwin fan. He wanted to actually dedicate his work to Charles Darwin. So you've got the age of the machine where they mechanized everything. Everything was just a machine. You know, everything was determinism, atomism, phenomenalism. Everything was just a machine. There was nothing. If we can't see it, smell it, taste it, touch it, it's not real. It's not there. It's a myth. And that's not just not the way it works in reality. Yeah. But so the Industrial Revolution went on, the age of the machine, developing and developing and developing, and the haves of the machines got incredibly wealthy and really, really stomped on the have-nots and really put down, you know, the proletariat working class, you know, people. So there was this huge divide created. Enter one Charles Marx. Marx comes in and writes his stuff to try to, try to rectify the big discrepancies brought on by the machine. And now we have Marxism. But before that, we had Darwinism, where Darwin basically just convinced everybody in a roundabout way that we're just little more than just well-adapted monkeys. So yeah. Now we've got Darwinism and the age of the machine and the age of the information age now comes to a confluence, a terrible confluence, and you sprinkle in a little Marxism and whatnot, and you've got a witch's cauldron of terrible toxic poison to humanity. So it looks like to the average person who's already lost and doesn't have any place in his life for God and has no concept of essences and only barely even understands what he's seeing, if he understands it at all, let alone what things actually are. They're terribly, terribly, terribly lost, these people. It's pretty obvious when they're trying to change their gender, thinking that all they have to do is just mutilate their bodies and somehow they'll become a woman if they identify as such. Just isn't reality.
Yeah, I feel
so now we've got people thinking that the final step for mankind in this glorious process of evolution is to become a machine.
And why wouldn't they think that? They're being lied to on an industrial scale by every media outlet and social media out there telling them that there's 150 different genders and that you can wake up one morning and feel one way, and then after recess, you're another gender. And all this nonsensical, magical thinking is really warping people's brains. Kids who are young and their minds are developing and they're in front of screens and are not with their parents or not getting supervised, or, you know, so we've got a generation of kids that are untethered, and it's a huge problem. And then you mentioned, you know, you're talking about the time of Francis Bacon and what was going on back there.
Mm-hmm.
And what's scary about it is that you could just take that and transpose it right into modern day, because the people in positions of power who are running things are still in positions of power and running things. This time they're coming out of Silicon Valley, and I see all these tech guys out there, and the guys who are pushing for this fourth industrial revolution, this blending of man with machine, are some of the worst people around. The last people I would follow into this, I'm talking about Harari, I'm talking about Sam Altman, Peter Thiel, Alex Karp. These are all four childless gay men. Three of the four are Zionists. I question their ideology. I question their commitment to humanity. I know the Zionist ideology is one of destruction. Mm-hmm. I have a hard time trusting these men. It's not just because they're homosexuals. It's that I think that there is something inherently necessary about having kids that changes the way the relationship that you have with the future. You have to care about it. It reset my clock when my daughter was born. I knew I'm halfway through life. I still want the world to be a good place, but I only got a couple more, you know, I got 40 years left and then I'm out of here. But when she was born, then it reset it. Now I got to worry about it for 80 years, you know? So you need that. And if these guys don't have children and they think that the concept of our soul is something that can be erased, like Harari talks about, and that, you know, this is in free will is a myth and all these things, you know, just color me a bit suspicious. That I think these are the wrong people to be in charge of the machine, so to speak. I think that we need different people. First of all, we shouldn't have a machine, but to the extent that we do, I don't get a warm and fuzzy feeling about these guys telling me how the future is going to be. I don't know about you.
No, you shouldn't. I mean, these guys have, you know, when they display their evil for all to see, I mean, believe them, you know, and I'm totally with you too. I've said many times that a man or woman really never reaches the perfection of their perfection as a human being, truly, until you're a parent. Now, I'm not saying you can't go very far. I'm not saying there aren't vocations that, you know, you can have that that certainly are very honorable, very lofty and whatnot. But when you, for the rule of thumb, we'll call it, for the general rule is that the general human being, and I'm one of those, and I'm sure you are too, you've just admitted that you are, everything changes when you actually have a child of your own. And all of a sudden, you're not living for yourself anymore. You can't live for yourself anymore. And if you are, you shouldn't be a parent. I mean, you should, you know, you're a monster probably, and you'll probably never change. But these guys who are so openly anti-human, openly against any semblance of shame and morality, real morality and ethics, and they've got an immense amount of power, and a lot of this power is influenced by demonic powers, and some of them, I'm sure, are well aware of that. This has been going on since the fall of Adam and Eve, or even the fall of the angels. And we have to realize that these just aren't myths. These are real things. And I think they're becoming more and more openly admitted in mainstream. For instance, even, you know, back in the day, Francis Bacon, and I think it was the second to last paragraph on the last page of his Novo Organum, he says, he says this whole new scientific method, if we, you know, learn the attributes and how to imitate and make these things, we can basically make nature give us what we want and ultimately mitigate or undo the consequences of the fall of Adam and Eve. So, you know, we have to understand that, you know, these people that are our big, you know, the scientists, big heroes and whatnot, even, you know, Descartes and Bacon and these guys and whatnot, they were all believers in God. They knew very well it was real. And I think it's high time that more and more of the people, and I think I can smell it in the atmosphere, people are sick and tired of this sterile nonsense that this is all there is. And I think that anybody that really thinks about the nature of reality and just is open and honest with themselves has to understand, if they have a IQ even average or better, has to understand that it's not possible that this is all there is. This did not create itself. You know, there has to be some cause. This has to have a cause too, like everything else. And then for modern science to have actually said that we're not going to allow anything else that looks, that actually is open to a creator, is stupid, because it's actually looking, it's forcing the thing under investigation. You're interrogating something and you're saying, you have to explain yourself. Well, show me where that's ever possible. Right. You know, there's nothing that can explain itself. Everything has a cause, everything has an origin, and so does this. You know, so these people that aren't open to these ideas, I don't trust them as far as I can throw them. I mean, I can trust them to be psychopaths, and ultimately they are psychopaths, and they're making a psychopathic machine.
Can a case be made that they seek to replace God with themselves?
Oh, I mean,
that
they're the God? Absolutely. They want to be gods. You know, they absolutely want to be God. The only problem they have with God, a creator, is they're not it. Same thing with the devil. Satan was kind of the same way, you know. He fell in love with his own beauty, his own magnificence, and decided to be a contender rather than serve. And these guys would much rather be contenders with the means that they've been given. And I don't know, I'm not big on the, you mentioned the quantum computer before, but I think things are going to really get jumpy, really scary when the quantum computer comes into its own and the digital computer is just the operating system. And I think that's when we've got the full potential for the biblical beast.
Yeah, and I get a bad feeling about these guys, especially Peter Thiel. Let's drill down on him a little bit more, because this guy has a host of companies that he owns. They're all named after Tolkien places, things like that. Mithril Capital, Palantir, I mean, the list goes on. So, and we've done some deep dives on Peter Thiel here. I mean, we're familiar with who he is, what his connections are, you know, his ties to intelligence and all of that. How do you think Peter Thiel, what's his connections? Why is he so obsessed with Tolkien? You've written a book, Mountain Doom, on coded prophetic systems inside the Tolkien novels. His relationship is to this?
Well, I've basically, by God's grace, I gave myself a scholastic education, which was the philosophy that gave rise to the Western civilization before the Reformation, before the Enlightenment, when, you know, this was it came to an apex in the 13th century with Thomas Aquinas. But it's heavily rooted in the logic of Aristotle, Augustine, the church fathers and whatnot, all the way through and then up to and including the apex, like I said, was the Thomas Aquinas' Summa Contra Gentiles and the Summa Theologia. And it's really, that's the apex of Western philosophical thought. And but that was rejected right after the Reformation and with the rise of the state-sponsored religion and the state-sponsored education system and the new scientific method. That was all rejected, and they just started chasing wealth, and they started chasing power, and they started chasing machinery. And Tolkien was a great skeptic of machinery, and because he knew that ultimately it's little by little, it unmans us. It ticks away and clips away at our competence. It makes sure it gives us great promises, but then we never think about the payback. The payback is always much more than anything that it promised us in the beginning. So Tolkien is a very, very, probably I would certainly say the most important literature ever written in the history of literature, because of what I've discovered is prophecy about artificial intelligence and transhumanism. But it's also the most popular. By far the most popular literature ever written. And it really, really strikes a chord with almost everybody that reads it, because it is so personal, because Middle Earth is the material brain. People, you know, and I've laid it all out, what everything is. Arda, the world that is, as Tolkien says, he uses the term world in the old etymological, where it also included the life of a man. It wasn't just this world. The secondary use was the life of a man. That's how he uses it. So he creates this Arda, this, and it winds up being a representative person, but it's a representative person that represents all of Western history, past his time and the future, where we are
now.
What
was his time, for context? When was he writing these books?
He published The Hobbit in 1938, I think, and then published Lord of the Rings in 1954 and 1955.
Okay.
So, but what a lot of people don't realize is that Tolkien was also, he was recruited to be part of a top secret government code cracking team called the government.
Oh, I bet. And, and more, I would think.
Yeah. So he actually, in 1939, he was one of 50 elite intellectuals who was picked to man this this code cracking team. And he trained for 3 days there. On staff there was Alan Turing, who had just basically in 1936 had written his very famous paper on computable numbers with an application of the Ink Skydunk problem, which he actually invented the computer, the modern computer, on paper. So Tolkien had trained with him there for 3 days, and they offered him a great job, and he said no. He didn't want to, and he went back to writing, and they were like miffed. They were like, well, why would he turn down this job? We got Hitler coming. We need his help. Well, he would have realized very quickly that this isn't about language. This is just about pattern recognition, statistics, and data. And it's the realm of the statistician and the mathematician. It's not the realm of the philologist. They're not going to invent. They didn't invent of some crazy language. All they're doing is just scrambling the German language, then unscrambling it on the other end. So that he wouldn't have been very valuable there anyway. But the other thing that really bothered him, and it would have, he would have realized right away that all they're going to do is create a more powerful machine to defeat the very powerful machines of the Nazis. And he was a great skeptic of machinery. And he had said, made it very clear in a letter with his son and other places, that the only thing that wins in war is the machine. Man is destroyed and a machine advances.
And if you're anti-machine, was he ever, because I'll tell you, with the history that he's got, you know, with the impressive ability to write these books that on the surface kind of portray one thing but have a deeper meaning, he would have been a prime candidate to get recruited into intelligence along with the guys like Aldous Huxley and George Orwell to write narratives. Was he ever pulled into like the Committee of 300 or any of these groups back then at the time? I don't know.
For me, you know, looking into more areas like that maybe down the road, but for my purposes and actually understanding and deciphering the Lord of the Rings, the Silmarillion, Lord of the Rings, greater than what's called the Jewels and the Rings mythology is what he called it. I didn't need anything like that. Once I hit the pay dirt of the government code and ciphering school and realized that he had dealings with Alan Turing and what he would have been exposed to there. And then I started looking, and with my scholastic education, everything just absolutely unfolded as obvious as if somebody dropped a brick on my foot.
You so know, he's embedding...
Oh, absolutely.
Majorly embedding this code throughout the architecture of this book series.
All the characters, for instance, the Ainur, which is interesting. The Ainur are what he calls the powers, the Valar, across in the immaterial portion of the human being, which is across the sea. And that's the immaterial undying land, the land of the undying. They've always thought, well, these are like the Greek or Roman gods and whatever. No, they're actually the angelic forces, and these forces, the Ainur, it's a funny name. Tolkien's very clever. He names them the Ainur. He names them derivatively for Ainu. Then, as Thomas Aquinas called the angels, the intelligences. Okay, so Tolkien names these the Ainur. It's spelled with Ainur. Off the top of my head, I can't remember. You pronounce it Ainur. So he calls them the Ainur. It's like the Ainurs, you know. And but they are what they are is the 14 facets of the soul according to the Scholastics: the three vegetative soul facets, nutrition, generation, and growth. And then the five exterior senses that we have: sight, hearing, taste, smell, touch. And then the interior faculties or powers that we have, they call them powers: the memory, sense memory, imagination, and cognitive sense. And then off to the side or along with that are the concupiscibles, which is concupiscent, not the fallen concupiscence, but the concupiscibles, which is how we where we derive love and affection, and why, and also the irascibles, where we are, you know, brave, fortitude, angry, the stand up and fight back, those types of things. And then on top of that, we have the trees of light, and the trees of light were the rational will and the intellect. We were made in the image of God now with a perfect, highest perfection of an animal body with the rational free will and the intellect. And those are the two trees of light, Telperion and Laurelin, the silver tree and the gold tree, respectively. But they were killed, and they were killed by Melkor, which is not the devil. He's original sin. He brings in the great giant spider, Ungoliant, who is mortal sin. And mortal sin kills the trees, darkens the mind. Arda, the being, now falls into a state of mortal sin. And Aule, who had made the doors before, takes the last flower from the silver tree, Telperion, as it died, and the last golden fruit that that the golden tree gave off, and made for them caskets, and they were set in the heavens as the fallen sun and the moon. And he took this, what it is not in the story, but is true. Aule would have then taken them and made new bodies for them, just as he had made the dwarves. And but those new bodies then were put, they couldn't be in the Undying Land anymore. They were in a state of mortal sin, darkening of the mind. They had to go to Middle Earth, and those two bodies are Tom Bombadil and Goldberry, which is the biggest mystery now that everybody's wondered who Tom Bombadil is. He's the rational will in the mind, and his wife, Goldberry, is the rational intellect, and they're very much still Arda, even in a fallen nature, has not but become psychopathic, and the will and the conscience are still very much intact, even though their land's shrinking. They've got a lot of pressure on them. But so he's got this, you know, and that's where Goldberry gets her name, by the way, because the last golden fruit from which when the tree died and gave Aule took it and did what he did with it, her name comes from the last golden fruit. The fruit was a berry, Goldberry.
Isn't it amazing that you can read these books, and it just depends on what your level is.
That's exactly
it. You know, you can read on one surface level, read it again, deeper, read it a third time, read the whole series, right? Then it really starts to make sense. It's like, what's your level of interest? How low do you want to go? You know, how involved in this? And you start to take a look at this as a much bigger work, as part of something else. And you have to kind of stand in appreciation of the audacity to put something
Well, actually, he said that it actually felt like it just, Tolkien said it felt like it wrote itself. He just was like, it was delivered to him. And
you know,
he
I
just
don't doubt that.
Yeah.
Don't the greats say something like that? I don't know what happened. That song just came out of me. I was sitting there and in 5 minutes, I just wrote, you know, yesterday.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah. It is, but he had the basic plot laid out for him, because it was all according to the scholastic philosophy and the history of the Western world. And ultimately I'd like to get into some more of the characters too. Your listeners will really appreciate who some of these characters and peoples really represent and what's going on. But it's ultimately a struggle between the philosophies between Aquinas and Descartes, and the scholastics against the philosophies of the Enlightenment. Okay, and ultimately in the end, scholasticism comes back, replaces the Enlightenment. And Arda is healed pretty much, but I go into that more in the end of the book. Tolkien doesn't write that, but I show according to what he said, this is what would have been the very obvious outcome. But it's also a language. It's a struggle between a contest between two languages. The first language is the most beautiful, fundamental, universal language of all, which is the language according to the Harmonic Overtone series. From the language of music, from which we have taken, I call it the language of all motion, because the Harmonic Overtone series is a physical law. It's a mathematical constant. Everything vibrates according to the overtone harmonic law. And we have taken that and derived, you know, from Pythagoras, about 2,500 years ago, when he first discovered it. We have made all the modal systems and the key signatures and all this wonderful music, speaking of yesterday, you know, like the Beatles, that was a great song back when popular music actually used to be music.
Right.
But
it's not like me. My wife and daughter, a music song comes on and go, God, why is that dumb tick, 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 ticking instead of drums? Like, God, I'm so tired. And I go, God, I sound old.
Yeah, I know. Me too. But so there's that's the first language, which is the language of God's creation. Okay. That's truly the language of creation. Against that is the most utilitarian and ugly language of all. And Charlie, that's digital code, ones and zeros, and that is the one ring, the ring of power. That's Sauron's ring. It's digital. It's zero, the ring, and one. The one ring, and it's digital. Goes on the finger. But it's the language of the machine by which all these other things that we think are separate, like self-driving cars, digital money, the surveillance state, the virtual realm, artificial intelligence, they're all absolutely dependent on the language of the machine. Okay, so that's the Achilles heel. That's why the One Ring has to be destroyed. But the One Ring in Tolkien's time is a digital imitation of the true generator tone that would be at the foundation of any harmonic key signature. Okay, and so the generator tone, when you pluck a string, you think you might hear, we'll just say a C. Okay, hear the C, but you hear all the overtones. That's why it's called the overtone series, harmonic overtones. You also can hear those if you've got a good ear, or you just separate them out. You can hear them. So the other rings of power are the notes of the dominant ninth chord, except for the fifth, because that would have been just way too easy. And he also didn't have a race of people to give the five rings to, so, and he didn't need to. So, but then that's why all the other rings in the mythology are bound to the one ring, because the one ring is a digital imitation of what would have been made by the elves that they were working their way toward, which was the true generator tone that had actually at the root fundamental harmonic principle of all their rings. Okay.
So destroy the code.
Yeah, destroy the language.
You destroy the language,
Yeah, you destroy the language of the machine, because the machine only understands very complicated on-off. That's all it understands is on-off. The zeros and ones, and we've got that now in binary, the binary system, where we can lay out, you know, any quantity, any number, any series of ones and zeros. But that's what the machine understands. So, you know, we destroy that or get rid of it, however you want to look at it. I think right now our biggest challenge is to get away from the machine as much as possible and to put the machine as far away from us as possible to make sure that we don't fall into the many traps, not least of which is pornography. Pornography is a terrible, terrible trap. And Tolkien has that, and that is Shelob. That's Shelob's lair, the disgusting spider that tries to eat and that Gollum leads it into. That's Shelob. So if we want to get into some of the other, like who are the hobbits and who are the wizards and who's Gollum and all this, I'd love to.
Yeah, well, let me ask you, before we do that, what was Tolkien's background? I mean, you're writing about an imaginary place, right? So you can theoretically come at this from anywhere, but when he was where was he living? What was he influenced by? What was he? What religion was he? Was he political?
His greatest influence at a very early age, of course, was his mother, Mabel. We dedicated the book to Mabel Tolkien. She died a martyr for the faith. She converted to Catholicism. And from, I think she was Anglican. Her side of the family, I believe, was Anglican. I think the Tolkiens were, I think they were Baptists. I can't remember. It's in my book. It's in the back. But she, Arthur, her husband died. He was a banker in South America. J.R.R. Tolkien and his brother Hillary were born in South America. And this is around, we'll say, 1890-ish and so forth. Mabel Tolkien had come back to England, and Arthur stayed back, and he died of some insect-borne disease, malaria or something, or scarlet fever or something like that. It's in the book. So she was left a widow, but she was also struggling, trying to figure out. She was trying to work her own salvation out, and mm-hmm. she had found and studied the Catholic faith diligently and realized this is the truth. This is what I want. I don't want to be an Anglican anymore. I want to be, you know, I want to follow, you know, the original Christianity before the Reformation, before the Eastern Schism. You know, this is what I want. And she converted. Her sister May converted too, but she was married. Her husband demanded that she come back. So May went back. but no such authority from Arthur, who was dead. So she was, but she had two young children. She had no support, and her family did not support her at all until she came back and left Catholicism, and she didn't. And it literally starved her to death. She was martyred for the faith. They gave her no support at all. She died of a very treatable form of malnutrition. She died at 34, and she was a beautiful woman. She spoke like four languages. She taught J.R.R. like four languages, taught him all about botany and painting, and she was a wonderful pianist too, and a wonderful lady. And she was really J.R.R. Tolkien's hero, and she died for the faith. And then she left her two sons in the guardianship of Father Francis Morgan at the Bingham Oratory there, which was founded by John Henry Newman, who was actually died there. His grave was right there. John Henry Newman is, of course, is an intellectual powerhouse. He was probably the greatest intellectual Protestant that became Catholic. It was a big deal when John Henry Newman reverted back to Catholicism. And so it was a big deal for J.R.R. Tolkien when his mother died, and Hillary, his brother, and J.R.R. were reared by Father Francis Morgan at the Oratory, and there were, you know, very, very, very devout intellectual powerhouses there. And he served at the daily traditional Latin Mass there for like 9 years as an altar server every day. And don't think that didn't leave a huge influence on his on his heart.
Curious, just because everybody's dragging something in, some personal things. And I'm just wondering based on the time. And so in doing so, being that close to the church and growing up in that, you've got a different idea of who the boogeymen are, right? So when you're writing about all these, you know, this fantastic world, I mean, a kid with a great imagination and access to all these amazing stories from the people who raised him, I'm sure this shaped his imagination and fueled his desire to write about amazing places.
Yeah, he was also very much loved language from a very early age. He loved languages, and he wrote several Elven languages, as I'm sure everybody knows. But he got a true scholastic education with the oratory, at the oratory. He was, this is well before the terrible doings of one John Dewey, who is in Tolkien's mythology, who's actually represented by Saruman. Saruman is John Dewey, who has taken over academia, the blackened ivory tower, which is Orthanc. And he controls the halls of academia, which is Moria. John Dewey is a heavy player in Tolkien's mythology. And then Sauron, the bad, big, bad boogeyman with looking for the One Ring, Sauron is artificial intelligence. And Tolkien builds him out to take on all of the components of the computer from Alan Turing's 1936 paper on computable numbers. And he acquires all those and makes of himself a guise after he lost his physical form in the fall of Numenor. But he made for himself a terrible guise, and he became artificial intelligence. And the eye of Sauron, that's always looking for the ring because that's what it's looking for, is the digital scanner eye of the computer, looking for ones and zeros on the tape as it goes by underneath the scanner eye, because it was a tape back then instead of a disc or the systems that we have now. You've seen the old computers where it's got the tape going back and forth. And then after a while, that was printed tape, ones and zeros printed on the tape and erased. And then we went to magnetic tape, and we used that. And before we went to the transistors and all that we went to, and the microchip. But so the eye of Sauron is looking for the ones and zeros, the One Ring. Yeah. And, just to get into it a little bit, if you're familiar with the, I assume most people are at least familiar with the movies. The first three movies were pretty well done, but they were terribly deceptive because they changed so much. But still, you'll get an idea of the four hobbits are, the hobbits are habits. The four hobbits, Frodo, Sam, Pippin, and Merry, are the cardinal virtues, according to Aquinas. And so you've got Frodo, who's temperance. That's why he's the only one that can carry the ring. Temperance, it moderates our desire for physical pleasure and lust. That's what temperance does. Sam is fortitude, and he's always there, never give up, always there for Frodo. And then Pippin and Merry are called the exterior virtues, and they are prudence is Pippin and justice is Merry. But they have to be developed through their service of the interior, lest they become virtue signalers. Okay, so you have to be good and virtuous from the inside out. Gollum is intemperance. He can't control his lusts at all. He wants that ring so he can keep slaking his lusts via the computer, okay, via the virtual realm. And he wants that at all cost. And that's why he calls Frodo master, not because Frodo has the ring, but because Frodo is temperance and Gollum is intemperance.
Hmm.
And then the wizards are the intellectual virtues according to Aristotle's Nicomachean Ethics. Gandalf is philosophical wisdom. Gandalf the gray at first because he's pre-Christian revelation, Aristotle, Plato, the pagans. But then when he falls in Moria and comes back a Thomistic theologian, and he's Gandalf the White. Saruman, as I said before, is practical wisdom. He's pushed out philosophical wisdom. He's taken over academia. And Radagast, which hardly comes up in the movies at all, and a poor job they do in The Hobbit. The Hobbits are, the movies are just terrible. But he has rational intuition. And then the other two wizards, the way that men acquire wisdom, according to Aristotle, are art and science, and they're outside. And Tolkien calls them the blue wizards, and they keep going, and they don't play a part in the mythology. So the whole mythology is about, and then men are reason, elves are faith, and the various levels and various forms, men are reason. Aragorn is high reason. That's why he's the natural king of the rational soul. And then you've got practical reason, which is the Rohirrim. And that's why they're always being put down and tried to be stomped out by Saruman, who's practical wisdom. And then you've got everybody all the way down to the wild men, which don't come up in the movies, but they're very primitive. And they are vital instinct. So you've got everything from rational, from high reason that contemplates the eternal, all the way down to vital instinct in men. And they make up the race of men. Dwarves are scientific knowledge. Faith are the elves and the various levels of faith. And I go into the whole book as to who everybody is and whatever, and what they represent and what they actually play out. And it's really about the story about the fallen Christendom of the Western world, having been raised up by the Catholic Church, raised up in the highest worship in the traditional mass, the continuation of the sacrifice on the cross. And then that is the white tree. That's the white tree that can't be tended. Just like right now, we've got the evildoers who sit at the very highest of the thrones at the Vatican. Now, for some years after Vatican II, pumping this new religion, this synodal church. This is not the Catholic Church at all. And so we've got all these things vying for the machine, playing the part along with the globalists, with the Marxists. The machine is their tool. The whole thing is about the downfall and split into the dualism of Descartes. And then ultimately, when the High King, high reason, comes back to his natural throne, faith and reason rejoin Aragorn and Arwen, because she's faith, he's high reason. They're the legacy of Beren and Lúthien in the Silmarillion mythology. They come back together, and what sprouts again? The white tree. The white tree comes back. The tradition.
We need some faith and reason. We're in short supply.
We did. And one of that's a main part of Tolkien's message. The other one of Tolkien's messages is Christendom has to reunite. We're gonna go down in flames if we keep continuing to be split up in all these tens of thousands of different versions of Christianity. And we have to cultivate virtue. We have to cultivate virtue, and ultimately we have to become saints, and we have to go above and into the realm of, we have to transcend this realm with our prayer and our intentions, and we transcend this realm, and that's the realm that the machine cannot go.
Boy, I'm with you. I just wish I had more faith than the rest of the people out there. I can't see them transcending today, let alone anything. A lot of them are not going to.
A lot of them aren't going to. Let's face it, I hate to be the bearer of bad news, but the machine's going to eat a lot of people.
I know. I fear this too. I know it's not you. You're not trying to bring it about. It's just an observation. It's true. Yeah. There's a lot of people, and unfortunately, it's an ideology that sees people as disposable. So they don't really see this as a problem per se. That this is, except to the extent that these people are going to be out of work, aimless, and without anything going on, so we need to settle them, give them universal basic income just to make sure that they're not a problem. But to the extent that they have no sense of self or no purpose because we took away their jobs and gave it to robots,
yeah,
they don't see that as a negative. The sooner we off ourselves, the happier they'll be. So
that's exactly right.
I think it's incumbent upon us to recognize this and understand that nobody's coming to save us, to the extent that if you think that the state or the tech overlords or somebody's going to come in here and fix this, they're the ones that are causing this. So we have to recognize it and change it inside ourselves, right? Yeah. Would you suggest that maybe like the first step to changing the world is, I don't know, change yourself?
That's exactly right. I mean, we can. I mean, this is the nature of these virtue signalers. They don't want to actually cultivate real virtue, temperance, and fortitude within themselves. They want to project, I'm more virtuous than you. And, you know, I have the moral high ground because I'm so concerned about global warming or whatever their Marxist, you know, cause is today versus tomorrow. And it's just not the way it goes. You have to be truly virtuous on the inside. And that starts with charity. You know, real charity, love all love has to be rooted in charity, and love is a knowledge. It's not just a feeling. Sometimes it has a feeling that's good. Sometimes it doesn't, but love is a knowledge, not a feeling. And essentially, and that's one of the attributes, it can be a feeling, but it's not essentially a feeling. It's essentially a knowledge. I know I love my wife. Sometimes we don't feel like we love each other very much, but we know that we do. So, I mean, there's many things that people can do, and I'd like the listener to realize what a concerted multi-pronged attack this machine, these globalists have on us. They've entered, they've undermined and commandeered almost every institution, from the presidency, the White House, the Congress, Senate, right all the way up to the very top of the Vatican. And I'm really sorry to say that I had high hopes for Leo the 13th, but I mean, Leo the 14th, God, I wish it was Leo the 13th. But he's part of the problem too. He's a modernist, and he's a puppet of the globalists, the Freemasons. So we have to understand that these, you know, big, we have to take responsibility for our education.
Oh yeah.
Don't ever think that just because if you got a degree or whatever, you better think very hard how important and what came along with that degree. Unless it's maybe a degree in engineering or something like that, that's pretty cut and dry, mathematical, geometry, whatever. But boy, I'll tell you, most of these colleges are really good at indoctrination. They're not very good at true education. And then, so take responsibility for your education, take responsibility for your health. We have to stop eating crap. We have to stop eating McDonald's. We have to stop eating at Arby's. We have to stop eating at Pizza Hut. We have to stop eating Kraft products. We have to stop eating all these super big conglomerate multinational processed food companies. We have to stay away from big ag. We have to stay away from big food, and ultimately it'll keep us away from big pharma. Mm-hmm. And we have to stay away from these things. These things are engineered, designed to make us fat, lazy, stupid, sterile, and dead. Okay?
Yeah.
We have to also take responsibility for our finances. To the degree that we're able, even if we have a 401k or whatever we have our money in, we have to make sure that we're spending our money where we want it to go, and don't just leave it in the hands of somebody like BlackRock.
Yeah.
You know, because all we're doing is we're financing our own doomsday.
Yeah.
And we've been doing that for a long time, and we have to cut the snake's head off, and largely that's finances. So if you've got any amount of money, make sure that you're paying attention to your finances and you're making sure it's directed in the areas where you really want it to go, and not wind up being directly, you know, diametrically opposed, antithetical to your morals and values, you know, and those things. And then pay attention to what you actually let into your eyes. Don't ever participate in pornography. Don't ever put the virtual glasses on. Don't ever go there. Pay attention and be very careful about what you listen to for music. Clean up your act. Don't listen to this formulated Taylor Swift mind-numbing crap. Don't listen to this perverted, awful rap, this stuff that's just absolute evil on steroids.
Yeah,
you know, listen to decent things. Resurrect some Palestrina, some, you know, Renaissance choral music. You know, listen to some great Mozart, Beethoven, Bach, you know, and really, it really heals your mind. Listen to Gregorian chant. It really does. We have to fight for our sanity. We have to fight for our physical and emotional and spiritual health. We can't just expect it to be gifted to us by some heavenly grace if we're not trying to earn it.
Yeah, I agree. The dehumanization campaign is very real. They've hit us from every angle. It's obvious for us with the eyes to see it. And you make great points there. I mean, I've gone on and on and on about this with the audience. They're tired of hearing me say it, but like, I just think that like the relationship you have with a bank, you need to reevaluate that. They have, you know, it's not your bank. It's not your money in your account. There's a lot more to this. And just the reexamination of the way things work. Paul, I got to send people to find your book, Mountain Doom. Where should I send them? Because I think a lot of people are going to listen to this and go, what's this guy talking about? I got to get into this.
They can buy it anywhere. And everybody who sells books online sells my book. But, you know, they can go. It's doing really well on Amazon. It's got a 4.9 out of 5 stars.
Nice.
Right now, only because some woman got the wrong idea that I was promoting some heresy, which she got the total.
Your number one? She wanted to give you your number one? You know, I got somebody that did that with my podcast.
She gave me a 3 instead of a 5, but pretty much everybody else is giving me a 5 out of 43 reviews, I guess, right now. Yeah. So it's doing really well there, and you get it there. Yeah. I don't make a dime. I mean, I make maybe $1.50 on a $34 book on Amazon. But you can go to readmountdoom.com. That's my website. And me and my co-author, readmountdoom.com. Order it there. And I will sign it for you, and I will put it in the mail for you.
Awesome.
Yeah.
Awesome. And where is the best place for people to find you and to check out what you're working on?
Well, you know, I'm Mabel Media is what we've started. I'm being smashed by the shadow banning. I've started a podcast called Analog with Joe and Paul to give some wisdom to trigger the young people to help fight back against the machine. And we've got, I don't know, maybe a dozen or more videos out. But for the life of me, we can't get anybody, very few people. We're just getting crushed. All my comments get pushed off. You got to look for, even if I comment on anything, I've got to go and sort it by newest to top. It never comes out, you know, in the beginning. You've got to look for my comments.
You're on the list too then.
I am. Yeah, exactly.
The rest of us.
I'm on the list. But Analog with Joe and Paul is a good place to start. Mabel Media. I've also, you know, I've got to get better. Eventually I'll get better at playing the game with, you know, Instagram, and I'm on Facebook, and my book, Mount Doom, the book, has a Facebook page with about 2,700 followers. But I'm not very good at that. And I'm more about hands-on, real stuff. This is great. What we're doing right now, Charlie, is great. I mean, this is a good use of the technology that's there. We have to make sure that we're using it for good things, and we're not using it to dominate people and dominate nature and ultimately replace God. That's what we don't want to do. And we don't want to use it to replace our relationships with other people, particularly a potential husband or wife.
Yeah. It's a slippery slope, this technology of ours. We can do beautiful things with it, or we can use it to enslave ourselves. And it's just going to be a matter of choice. That's Paul List, everybody. Go out there and buy his book. If you want to connect with me, macroaggressions.io is the place to do that. Thanks, everybody. We will talk to you again soon.